You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Mickey.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, you're back and you're wearing a non-zero hat, Mickey.
I know. Do I know how to suck up or what?
You're doing a good job. I'm feeling good about this.
I have trouble explaining this hat to people, though.
So. Seems pretty clear to me.
How would you explain it? A guy at the gym says, hey, that's a cool hat. What does it mean? What do I say?
You said you should subscribe to Bob Wright's Non-Zero newsletter?
No, I said a friend of mine wrote a book and he turned around and was not interested.
Well, you should get a new, what was this guy? Whatever he was, you should get a new one.
He was the guy at the front desk at my gym. And I said, well, can I check in? And he said, oh, you don't have to check in. You're iconic. I don't think I want to be iconic at my gym, you know?
What did he mean? He's aware of your
I think he meant I'm the old guy who barely works out.
Oh.
That's why I'm iconic.
You're an icon for old men everywhere. Well, good.
Anyway.
Mickey, you're back. I think we need to dwell on your very presence because people have been clamoring for this. Here you are. And they're curious, what did they do to deserve this? When is it that you do choose to grace this podcast question. With your presence?
I've been trying to do a lot of work on my house, and there was a period of a pause, and then all this sort of stuff was happening. And I figured if we just had a short hour-long conversation, which is just a conversation, not a whole shtick where I try to read John Ellis's news items and bone up on the real estate market in China and the newest scientific discoveries. And we just talked about the obvious things in the news that might be worth doing. Right. It'd be fun anyway. So, you know, and, you know, talk about your buddy Reid Hoffman covering himself with glory. Excuse me.
What, you mean by defending Biden early on or what?
No.
Is there more news?
At the big confab of elite oligarchs in, I guess, Sun Valley or something, where Peter Thiel said, your lawfare has turned allegedly a clown into a martyr, turning Trump, talking about Trump. And
wait,
Reid
Thiel
Hoffman,
called Trump a clown? That's the news. You buried the lead.
According to Hoffman, no, Thiel's always been ambivalent about Trump. But
got a funny way of showing it.
He does. But then Hoffman said, I wish he had been martyred, depending on which side of the story you hear. And then he tried to walk it back by saying, I meant self-martyr by holding himself accountable. Yeah, right. I don't quite believe that. And then
I'm reserving judgment.
And then there's his, you know, all these oligarchs have like a political guy who they hired to do their politics for them. And, TLS one or two maybe, and Hoffman has one who immediately upon the attempted assassination on Trump said, people aren't taking seriously enough that this was a Putin-like staged assassination. You know, so he immediately raced for the conspiracy
but
theory.
But he walked that back and apologized, right?
Which is a very... I'm sure he did, but I don't know if the guy did. Maybe Hoffman
did. No, he
did.
Anyway, no, I don't mean.
It was
I don't mean Reid. I mean the guy himself apologized. I read about this part.
Anyway, it was embarrassing. And there's always the trips to Epstein Island if you want to have a third one. So, I would say he's not having a good week, your boy. But that's not what we're here to talk about.
Well, I don't know. We'll see. The worse week Trump has, the better week he has, and the better week many of us have. And I wouldn't say Trump's speech last night was like. I thought there was an opportunity there that he actually didn't take.
After
the assassination attempt, and you know, you were hearing, gosh, he seems changed. The first night of the convention, he looked humble, genuinely moved, a new Trump. I thought, well, first of all, he may actually feel like becoming more of a national healing figure, which I think would help him electorally. It would move some voters who are quite skeptical of him. And in any event, I thought, even if he wants to fake it, the attempted assassination will make it seem credible. I mean, if a few weeks ago he had shown up and said, I'm a national healer, people would have said, yeah, right. But after the assassination attempt, he could have sold that story. And in fact, the word in advance of the speech was supposedly it was going to be a unifying speech.
And there
but
was
the only
some
time
that.
I...
At the beginning, there was 25 minutes on the assassination where he did have a subdued tone. In fact, he had a subdued tone throughout. He was tired and he was like lower energy than usual, but he also seemed contemplative and wistful. He had this weird look. We'd never seen him like that before. So he
Are
was
you
not,
serious?
All the pros, like Jeff Greenfield, Jim Fallows, even Peggy Noonan, not so much, but all the pro speechwriters say it was a terrible speech. Some people say it was ruinous. Well,
of that's ideologically motivated. None of them are Trump fans.
But let's look at the look. But some people who might be Trump fans, like Barry Weiss, were pissing on the speech too. It was not menacing. Okay, he was very toned down, so he didn't have. You know, let me finish my five ways the speech was good. Was not menacing, which was important for winning women's suburban voters. It did have a sort of new tone. It was rambling and conversational once you got through with the assassination part. But that why is that necessarily bad? You know, these speechwriters all like the Seth speeches. He should give the Gettysburg Address, damn it. No, he's a rambling conversational guy. So he gave his stump speech. So what? It was appealing to a lot of people. Plus, it gave a very good idea of how he thinks. I don't think it was inauthentic. I think you're an insight into the mind of Trump. If you like the mind of Trump, vote for him. It had, unlike Biden, it solved the what is it all of the Peggy Lee problem. What is it all about? Why are we working so hard in this country? Where is it going? Biden has completely failed at that. Trump at least said
is that all there is, one might say.
We're gonna cure cancer and Alzheimer's, we got great things ahead of us. Okay, at least that's something. We're working a cure, you know,
Wait, I missed this part. Was there existential reflection that I just passed over?
It wasn't existential reflection. He just talked about great scientific discoveries, and there was some weird internal thing.
Yeah, but they were
going to
be
like,
great. He didn't say, but what about our spiritual exploration? He just said, hey, cool shit coming.
Well, that's better than what Biden's done, and the cool shit happens to deal with issues of mortality. And you know, he has. I contrast him with Vance. So my one objection to Vance was talking about his burial plot. Now he looked forward to being buried in the burial plot of his family. Okay, I hated that. I don't want to be. I want him to defeat
mortality. Yeah, but you've
mortality.
Got a death thing. You've got this heavy death aversion, Mickey. You got to come to terms with this. Everything is impermanent.
A lot of boomers have a heavy death aversion at the moment. I want him to cure the cause of death and extend life for 20 years.
Wait, you
I don't
want Trump
to I don't
cure?
Want to look forward to be buried in a fucking family burial plot. So Trump's
you
vision
was
better than
Vance. You want a president who brings literal immortality.
That'd be
you
good,
want him to
but
cure
I'll,
death.
I'll settle for life extension.
Okay.
Anyway, he at least talked about that. That was in the speech. He did not say, I alone can do it. He characterized himself as part of an unstoppable movement. That doesn't mean that I alone can do it. It means even if you kill me, my movement cannot be stopped. Okay? That's what you would think after somebody had tried to kill you, but it was not I alone can do it. And there was very, very little, maybe a trace element of election denialism. He did not.
There was explicit election denialism.
No, he said they cheated and we're not going to let them do it again. He didn't say I really won.
Wow, he really coded that message. It was really clever of you to pick up on the meaning of that, Mickey.
Well, if you say he cheated, that could mean you instituted these COVID reforms that let too many people vote. You know, it doesn't mean you know you move the ballot boxes in Fulton County, Georgia.
I think there was more than one reference to the election. But
anyway, those are my reasons.
Where
why
are we on your bullet points?
We're through with my bullet points. That's why I think it was a pretty good speech. Not a great speech. Could have been better.
You know,
it was okay.
Look, I didn't think it was a bad speech. I mean, in the sense that I thought it had some good moments. To me, it looked like a classic, an actual classic Trump appearance. He didn't seem low energy to me. Of course, I've been watching Joe Biden. So, you know, what doesn't seem high energy after that? And in fact, one thing I was thinking was among the many reasons they got to finally drive a stake through Biden's heart is that if he does go up on that convention stage, the comparison between Biden's vibe, and even what you call a subdued Trump is going to be so glaring. I mean, Biden just can't show up anywhere without looking old anymore. I mean, the NATO press conference, you know, which his backers are comparing to like climbing Mount Everest or something, viewed in isolation was just not impressive.
Yeah. So it's not over. He's dug in his heels. It's him versus Pelosi. And Mark Halperin versus Robert Costa. And Halperin's latest post was, you know, Biden is digging in and Pelosi's bringing the pain, and the pain is making Biden dig in even more.
So that's the danger.
We're ratcheting up to Armageddon levels of pain.
That's the danger.
The only way it's resolved is when Pelosi crushes Biden like the climax of a Marvel comic movie, you know?
Yeah. I'd be in favor of that. But it's not only her, right? I mean, Schumer. We've had, you know, the leaders of both the Democrats in both houses. I mean, first, apparently, they talked to him. That didn't work. So they, I guess, leaked the fact that they had talked to him.
Right.
I mean, everyone seems to be escalating. We just need more people to join in.
They're joining in today. They're like, you know, they're pouring in from the House today.
Are they? So yeah. How many?
Yeah, I think it's 35 now. But
whoa! But only three senators, right?
I think so. And the weird thing is, the problem with this whole thing, and I think Pelosi is being the most energetic behind the scenes, is as Nellie Bowles,
at every opportunity, yes.
Her column had gotten worse when she was, like, you know, busy having a child. Now she's back and her column is fantastic again today. Talks about Nancy Pelosi would put a horse's head in your bed and she would have cut it off herself. Okay, that was her line today. So Pelosi's in the process of doing that. The point seems to be to get rid of Biden and replace him with Kamala, and Kamala's not going to do any better. That's the weak point.
She may do better, but that's not my plan. My plan is Whitmer Booker in 2024.
That's a good plan. That's fine. The idea that John Tester, who just called for Biden to step aside, wants to run with Kamala Harris in Montana. I mean, that's always been the problem. A lot of these Midwestern guys who are in tight Senate races, Sherrod Brown, Tester, don't want to run with Kamala. They'd rather run with Biden.
Well, you know, you mentioned Mark Halperin. He had a post recently, maybe it's the most recent one, that I thought was dubious. I don't buy it. But he was acting as if there's this plan that it's going to happen. I guess it's Pelosi's plan or something. And it's not going to be necessarily Kamala. It's going to be an open contest. Did you see that post?
I think so. But the more recent things have been resigned to Kamala.
Ezra Klein, that was a very disappointing point number seven in his like 11th post thread on Twitter. I mean, when Ezra goes back to Twitter, you know we've got a national emergency in our hands.
What was point seven?
Look, folks, even I had advocated for an open thing, but you know, after this, and this was like yesterday when it seemed more like, but like we were assuming Biden was going to step down any moment, right. And he was saying, "But it's been so draining. I'm afraid, you know, we're going to have to kind of settle for Kamala." More or less said,
"This is like the end of World War II. I favor the Patton strategy, which is you defeat Nazism and you keep the tanks going until you also destroy Kamala." Right?
Whatever metaphor we'll push her off the stage. I'm in favor. Now, could we pause, Mickey, and maybe we should give credit to both of us. You were certainly on the J.D. Vance bandwagon early, but
I still am.
How long ago did you first hear me say, if the Democratic leaders are doing their job, they'll find a way to push Biden off the ticket and make this an open primary? More than a year ago. Do you remember my masterful plan that was going to be led by Obama?
You were prescient about it. It turns out that Biden really resents Obama, and Obama's the worst person to lead it. But yes, yeah. Aside from that, your impression.
I don't think it helps them leaking this thing about Obama necessarily. I don't think that helps.
And I was reluctant to admit that Biden was, had declined, because I always thought that he was there enough to govern, and he could always rise to the occasion on the key moments like the State of the Union. But then came the debate, and he didn't rise to the occasion. So that changed my mind, as it changed to many people's minds. And he obviously, I still think he's capable of being president for the rest of his term, but he's obviously not capable.
For the rest of this term.
Yeah. But he's not capable of another.
Yeah, like showing up at the White House, sure, because he lives there. He can do that.
Not now, but yes, he can. At the moment, he's in Rehoboth. But but yes, and so, he could be a brain in a jar for another 4 months. And that'd be fine. But yes, you were righter than I was on Biden's decline.
I forgot that you were a skeptic, actually. There were so many skeptics on the liberal side that I was fighting them off, man. Cher finally fell in line. Jeez.
I was secretly hoping he would decline radically, because there is none of the other candidates' border policies could possibly be as bad as his. So I'll take a random candidate from the phone book over Biden. So that's my main motivation.
I mean, anyway, the reason I thought Trump had an opportunity to be national healer is because, for all he knows, he's going to face because after the assassination, I guess maybe this has tended to fade, but right after the assassination, I felt, man, national healing would really sell now. I felt it myself. It's like people are starting to understand this is getting out of hand. And I still think, for all Trump knows, he will face a candidate who hasn't been as hyperbolic in denouncing Trump as Biden has been, and can credibly say, look, why can't we all get along? In which case, Trump would like to position himself, strongly in that very territory. Anyway, he didn't do that. I mean,
he did a little bit of that. There were a lot of words in the speech.
The first time I heard him refer to national unity in the speech, he said, if the Democrats want national unity, they better stop these partisan witch hunts. That was his national unity message.
But then he went back to it later. It was in his prepared text. He didn't emphasize it.
Now, the speech, he's good. It had good points. I think this is this don't tax tips things new. I think that's genius. There's a lot of service workers, right? Who knows who you pick up with that?
Supposedly he stole it from Rand Paul, but yes, he claims he stole it from a waitress. So
that's a better story.
I would go with the waitress story, but
that's good. Some of the stuff on of course, there's a huge amount of misinformation in there. I mean, every other sentence is false, but the stuff about, there were all these wars going on now. There weren't wars when I was there. I mean, I think that's pretty effective, because it's basically true. Yeah. There were a lot of things that were pretty good, but I just think it should have been tighter. It should have been tighter.
Well, of course, but the general impression, and I need you to save me here, because as you can see, I can predictably feel the tug of Trump, and he's a lovable grandpa now. I mean, what was the problem with him anyway, Bob? You have to remind me, or else I'm going to be sucked into the vortex, and I really would rather not be sucked into the vortex.
Well, he did try to subvert the Constitution.
But that's just because he lost. Now he's winning, and he won't have that won't be an issue,
Well, still, it's kind of like a bad mark on his on the record of a president.
It's a bad mark on his record. It's a bad impulse to have.
The safety net isn't that he's winning now. It's that he's not in office, so he can't pull the levers he might have pulled to stay in office. A and B, it's his. If he gets elected, it will be a second term, and I think even he will not try to wind up getting a third term. Even the Supreme Court that he appointed one third of would not support that. So no, I'm not as worried about a repeat, but still.
The danger would be that he would do something that would so defy the Supreme Court, that would be so obviously extra constitutional that you'd have to call the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and say, which side are you on, right?
That's and look, he'll have a friendly Joint Chiefs chairman. He'll appoint him. And, you know, look, if even you are bringing that up, it must be a possibility.
Well, I guess that's right. But what drives me crazy and what would remind me that he's not just a friendly grandpa is him insisting that his subordinates lie for him. So it started with the crowd size at the inauguration, throughout the lie, if you wanted to be on the team. And I wonder how J.D. Vance is going to do that, cope with that, if there is such a demand. And I hold out hope that he's not making those demands anymore, because he's so lovable. He's become a god among men, like Ezra Klein. And he doesn't have to enforce that petty lying anymore.
Do you mean because of the assassination attempt, or because his tone has changed?
In part.
That'll fade. It faded more than it had to last night, because again, there was, I think, too much for his own good. There was just too much of the old Trump, completely egocentric and self-involved. I mean, Mickey, do you know what the bloodiest part of the body is, Mickey? The part that bleeds the most?
The ear, did I hear that from Trump?
Mickey, I mean, that's just so funny, because most of the stuff he says it's false, and there was a ton, is just a matter of like taking the real number and multiplying by three. But whenever he comes up with some totally new thing, you kind of have to ask yourself, like, how did this get? And my theory is, he said to the doctor, hey, tell me something. Is the ear is that the part that bleeds the most? And the doctor probably said, well, if that's where you get shot, yeah. And he just took that and ran with it, you know.
He just said, why is there all this fucking blood all over me? And it may be, if he's really savvy, it would be an attempt to counter this, what I think is a doom theory on the left, but it's embraced by a lot of respectable people, that he was really cut by a glass shard from the teleprompter and not a bullet at all. It doesn't make any sense because the teleprompters were intact. B, the guy behind him died, so there were obviously some bullets. So somebody shot at him with bullets. So what does it matter what pierced his ear?
Well, also, there's the amazing picture of his hand partly raised, and you can see the bullet zinging by in the New York Times picture. And if you ask, well, wait a second, that's too soon for his hand to be responding. But I think his hand was responding to the noise. He heard a shot, starts raising his hand, and the next shot got him in the ear.
They say that is a photo of the shard going through the ear, Bob, not the bullet. But it's insane, because
that's ridiculous.
The teleprompters were in front of him, and his ear was behind him. So it's,
well, they're not, and the teleprompters aren't shattered. I mean, this is crazy. There's a bunch of conspiracy theories on both sides.
You would be shocked at the people who embrace that.
Who? Name somebody.
John Alter.
No, he's not sticking with it, is he?
I don't know if he's sticking with it, but he said Trump lied when he said that a bullet pierced his ear. How does he know Trump lied?
I think the evidence is pretty strong.
And John Harwood was sort of leering at it. John Harwood is formerly respectable, a respectable person, totally respectable.
John Harwood? But this is all early, right? I mean, when I first saw it, it looked kind of weird to me. But that was just for the first like few minutes.
I don't think it's that early. Anyway, the on the national unity front, I was very moved by what Governor Shapiro said, and I thought it was very, in terms of actually being a step in the direction of unity. He gave this whole talk about Corey Comparator. Is that have you ever been up to the name? The fireman, mm-hmm. ex-fireman who had thrown himself on his family. And he said, and he was an avid Trump supporter. He was so happy to be there. Okay. That's all he said. Didn't trash Trump. Just said he was happy to be there. He was an avid Trump supporter.
Mm-hmm.
Biden would never say that. That's too much empathy for Biden. And it was very moving when Shapiro gave that to his opponents, and Biden would never do that. All Biden said was,
I think,
he supported the candidate of his choice. So the like, very dry, anodyne thing.
Now, that's exactly what, look, I've been all over Biden's case for a couple of years. You know, the thing you cited on Twitter back in 2022, I guess, when Biden went on about MAGA Republicans. I trashed him for that. Biden has been a disaster. He's been the worst thing.
It's a difference between a parent saying to their kid, you've been bad and you are bad, okay? He has a civil rights mindset, which I think he shares with John Meacham. They're good people and bad people. And my opponents aren't just misguided. They're not good people who've been led astray. They're bad people. They're in Charlottesville. They're bad people. And if you listen to his speech about the soul of the nation in Philadelphia, the red one, where it's, you know, it's all MAGA Republicans are bad people. He needs that somehow to keep himself going. And that's exactly what Josh Shapiro.
The problem isn't just a distinction. The problem isn't just the distinction between you are bad and you were bad. It's like generalizing to encompass all Republicans who support Trump. I mean, it's just stupid politics. It's just, and it's bad for the country. I mean, Trump, you know, is he getting more? I mean, I have been finding him slowly less noxious in a just a reflexive way, viscerally. I mean, I still would move heaven and earth to keep him out of the White House, but I've just thought I'm kind of getting inured to him. And I do think that's part of it. I'm just getting used to him. Because a lot of the things that annoy me are still there. The ridiculous self-involvement. Like, did you see the thing where while Nikki Haley was saying, while speaking at the convention, she was saying, President Trump asked me to come speak about unity. And and somebody showed the video of him at the same time, and you could read his lips. And as soon as she said, asked me to speak, he said she wanted to speak or something. Like, that is so Trump. Like, no. I didn't ask her. She asked me. It's like a 14-year-old at best. And he's like that in so many ways. And it's easy to lose track of what a bizarre phenomenon it is that he was president and may be president again. I mean,
if you have to resort to lip reading, though, he's not the old Trump. Sorry.
Well, he was. There was no microphone. So can I ask a little more about the Democrats? So how is this going to play out?
I deny that he was that self-interested, but the repulsive thing was that the only people on stage were his family. And Peggy Noonan picked that up. Usually at the end of a convention, you invite all the Senate office holders on stage and everybody in the party gets on stage, okay? It was only Trump and the Trumps and all the women look like supermodels, except for Usha Vance, who looked like a normal person, but she's also much too pretty. None of them, there were no normal Americans up there.
Ridiculous. Maybe he was afraid.
That's the way Trump does it. It's all his family.
Does he always do that? Because it was a bad look.
I don't know what he did last time. It's a good question.
Because it was a bad look, because by the speech had gone on so long. Everyone on Twitter, these were mainly liberals, of course, were saying, oh, my God, everybody in the auditorium is checking their phones. They want to get out of here, blah, blah, blah. Right. And it was starting to have that vibe. And then you're waiting for the throngs to, you know, enthusiastically rush on stage. Right. Nobody ever did. It was weird looking.
Right. The first on stage was Jared, which was a downer. So anyway, back to you were asking me something.
So first of all, I know you think I pay too much attention to the betting markets, but they do tend to embody the latest evidence and the conventional wisdom. And, you know, Biden was down to like 13%, and now at last check he was up to 30. This is alarming. I mean, the good news, now he's down to 26. But the good news is, now on this market, poly market, it's weird. They've got a Gavin Newsom column and then another, including Whitmer. I guess that's because she was late to be even included in the market, whereas they've got Hillary, RFK, Michelle, et cetera. Anyway, I'm happy to see that number. That had gotten super low. That's up to 16%. Gavin's down to 3. Good.
Other is at 16%?
Well, and other includes Whitmer. I think other is mainly Whitmer. And that's up to 16. Well, that's true. Actually, you're right. It's probably mainly Whitmer and Shapiro. I'm trying to think who else. Yeah. Anyway, what do you think is the strongest Democratic ticket, taking into account the need to keep as many Democrats, enough Democrats on board to win the election? So in short, yeah, the strongest.
I don't know Whitmer enough. I've been impressed with Shapiro. He's very Jewish. This may not be the year to be Jewish. But he doesn't hide it. I believe he observes.
You mean because of Gaza?
He might even keep kosher. Yeah, because the Democrats, not the pro Hamas faction, but the anti-Israel faction in anti-Bibi faction in the Democratic Party. It doesn't seem like the year of the Jew, you know. And I wish that wasn't true, so I don't know enough about Bashir. I don't know enough about Whitmer. I sort of know enough about Booker to like him, but I don't think he's that presidential.
Compared to what? I think a not bad ticket is Whitmer at the head and then Booker. Now, this is partly taking into account the claims that if Kamala's pushed aside, you will have some disgruntled Black voters in the Democratic Party and Black leaders in the Democratic Party. So it'd be nice to have an African-American on the ticket and maybe some disgruntled women. So I'm thinking, like, if you push a woman of color off the stage and your ticket has a person of color and a woman, how upset can they get? But maybe anyway.
Well, I think that helps. Two points. First, one of the arguments for Kamala is she has been vetted. No, she hasn't. Okay. Everybody agrees, at least Halperin agrees, and everybody on the call seems to agree. She hasn't been vetted. She may be vetted more than other people, but she's hasn't been vetted the way a presidential candidate is.
Well, do you think the thing with what's his name, the politician you so respect, the California, you know, Willie?
Oh, they're going to bring that up, but that's to her favor. Willie Brown's a really smart guy. She should. She'd be better.
Wait, off. It's to her favor that she had an affair with him. Wasn't he married? Yeah,
he was married, but he was long past the stage where normal people, I think, would have been divorced. But I don't know.
But it's not his behavior we're talking about.
Maybe he talked to her and drummed some sense into her. He's a really smart guy. I think her. I would like to think much more of her. She left her husband and went back to Willie Brown. Then we'd have a ticket. But
excellent idea.
And the second thing is, people are saying, "Well, there's not enough time." And here I again invoke our friend Bruce Feiler. There's plenty of time. There's time to have a mini convention. There's time to process information on all the candidates. There is time to do that before the deadline.
You know what they should do? They should have three things online, and they can just call them straw polls. But first, they say to the delegates, just pick anybody you want. It's all write-in. This is a write-in ballot. Everybody write somebody in. And then they take the three leaders after that, vote again, and then they have two vote again. And they can call it a straw poll going into the convention, but then everybody would kind of know what's going to happen.
They don't need that. It's an open convention. Biden releases his delegates. They can vote who they want. They are the electorate.
Yeah, but the trouble
is, candidates are the electorate, are the people that they vote for.
But then there's bitterness on the floor. In the old days, that was expected. It's like, you know, you fight it out on the floor, fine. But now the thinking is, look, the Republicans go into their convention united and put on the show and get Hulk Hogan and blah, blah, blah. We got to be able to set up our show and not spend the time actually arguing. It would be entertaining as hell. I'd love to see it.
I'm always for Discord. Maybe that's because of the family. You know, in my family, we just had it out immediately. We didn't suppress anything in the name of unity, and it worked. So I think the Democrats will understand that they can't get too vicious. It would be counterproductive if, you know, they said, you know, Jane, you ignorant slut. I mean, they're not going to do that. They're going to be civil about it. They're going to present a positive view of themselves. And if they lose, they're going to gnash their teeth in private.
I mean,
plus, you know, even if they lose, it's great for name recognition. They, as was pointed out by somebody on Halperin's podcast, they don't have to go through a campaign. So Andy Beshear can get mentioned as a presidential candidate without having the campaign.
Right. You know,
it's
the
like
other
manna from heaven for them.
The other virtue of A, getting rid of Biden, and B, possibly Kamala, is so that if they lose, they'll learn the right lessons. I mean, if Biden loses, they'll just go, well, next time, let's don't have an 81-year-old candidate. But the fact is, their problems are deeper than that. I mean, right, electorally, they have ceded too much ground in ideological terms to Trump and to Trumpists, right? Well, I mean,
no, they ceded too much ground to the left.
Well, no, but I mean, on things like immigration. In the general election, I mean, it's true that, well, it depends what you mean by
left. They conceded too much ground to the Trumpists? When did they cede ground to the Trumpists?
He opened the borders to
10 million people.
Yeah, they have ceded too much ground by not seeming to care to be tough at all tough on immigration.
Okay. Okay.
They have ceded too much ground to the Republicans.
Got it.
And as for the left, I think there's two kinds of lefts. There's the identity politics left, and there's the old-fashioned class-based left, which aims to see workers of all color as basically the same issue. And I think the Democrats have gone too far toward identity politics and not far enough back to old leftism, because that's the part that Trump and Vance are stealing from them, because they're convincing the white working class that Democrats don't care about workers if they're white, which isn't true if you look at their policies, but there still has been a miscalibration. And some of these issues, like, people who came, reach puberty as males competing in women's sports. I mean, that's just a giveaway to the Republicans. There's just very few people who think that makes sense.
There was a sense after Obama won twice that the Democrats don't need the white working class anymore. There was a disdain there. Tom Edsel wrote about it. He and a bunch of other people like Roy Tsheris said that was a really bad idea, okay? But there was this sense that they didn't care about the white working class anymore.
No, I agree. So, they've allowed that sense to fester. That's what I'm saying.
But you just seem to imply that, of course, they care about it. They just haven't publicized it.
No, I mean, if you look, if you compare the actual policies, like Republicans favoring tax cuts for the rich, for example, and Democrats doing a pretty good job of tending to the basics of assistance, various kinds of assistance for low income people. I don't think they're being egregiously derelict. I think it's largely a matter of the way they talk. And also, it's largely a matter of the way they talk about things.
Of course, I think they are being derelict. The Obama model, the emerging Vance model is we want wages to rise, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The Obama model was, well, there's structural forces in the economy that are limiting wages, but we can supplement it with the welfare state. Okay. Those are two competing visions. And I think the Democrats' vision is faulty. So who wants to be on welfare?
But,
we want a job.
But whenever minimum wage comes up, which party opposes raising it?
Well, I bet Vance doesn't oppose it.
Well, we'll see. But traditionally, you compare the past of both parties. And it's not
the same with the tax cut. The embrace of tax cuts was minimal and vestigial last night, I think.
Well, but what about last Trump administration?
No, he fucked up. He was.
Well,
he
but that's what I'm saying.
By,
you look at the actual.
He got conned by Paul Ryan, who's now
whatever. You look
know,
at the actual policy past of the two parties. Republicans cut taxes for rich people, oppose raising the minimum wage, and various other things that, lead to the substantive conclusion that actually the Democrats aren't egregiously disserving the working class. However, there is the perception that they are. And, part of it is immigration, and there are other things. But
the lesson of the Republican convention was supposed to be that's changed. So,
Well, all the more reason for the Democrats to shape up their messaging and even some of their policies. But anyway, my point is, you want, if they lose the election because of this, you want them to understand that that was the problem, that there's some substantive and messaging changes in order. It wasn't just that Biden was too old or that Kamala is a bad candidate. That's what I mean. That's one reason I want someone other than those two at the head of the ticket, a good candidate. And then I hope it'll mean we win, but if we lose, it'll at least cause soul search.
But if you have a good candidate who embraces this working class, pro-working class attitude and loses, won't the reaction be, well, he didn't go left enough. He didn't play on identity politics enough. He wasn't woke enough. You know, he's not part of the, you know, the...
No, I'm not talking about woke. I mean, seeming too woke is part of the
coalition of the
problem.
Ascendant. What?
Well, recommending more wokeness.
If a guy adopts your philosophy and loses, that discredits your philosophy. It doesn't help it.
That would be the case, yes.
So if Bashir embraces
But I'm predicting
a
that if you have a good candidate... If you have a good candidate embracing what I recommend, I'm predicting they'll win.
I think at this stage, that's very dicey because Trump's looking awfully strong.
Is he? I mean, what are the polls saying? By the way, did you see this weird 538 projection that had Biden winning? Did you see that?
Well, Nate Silver, who founded 538, has been ragging on them. They apparently value heavily a lot of factors other than the polls, like the state of the economy, the value of incumbency. So as the polls get worse for Biden, they predict more and more that he's going to win.
He's not running it anymore?
No, he has his own projection.
Well,
which shows that Trump is winning. The answer is, it was always startling as Biden's decline became front page news. And after the debate, the polls were still pretty close at the national level. Some of the swing state polls got pretty hairy for Biden, but they were still within the margin of error mostly. And now the national polls, I think, are starting to diverge. I think there's a CBS poll where Trump's ahead 5 points, not just 2 points.
Yeah, I saw that.
There's another poll where he's up 6 points. You know, well, given that the Democrat has to win by 2 or 3 or 4 points in order to win the Electoral College.
Yeah, but come on,
that really means he's 10 points behind.
The CBS poll was right after the assassination attempt and during the convention. Okay, so some of the bump may fade. Also, it's against Biden. We're hoping he's not going to be the candidate.
Well, the assassination isn't against Biden. The assassination is pro-Trump. But yes.
That is. But I mean, all the polls are comparing Trump to Biden. Biden is, they're not,
right,
you know,
right.
And nobody knows, since a lot of Americans haven't even heard of like Gretchen Whitmer and so on, there's no good polling data.
And the Filer Faster thesis says there's plenty of time for them to get to know Gretchen Whitmer. In fact, there might be the ideal amount of time because you'll learn the good things about her and you won't learn the bad things.
What do you think of her? I don't know that much about her.
I know nothing about her. Absolutely nothing about her. I've seen her. I hear she's great on TV. The donors love her, always a bad sign. But I saw her on some podcast. She was perfectly fine, you know, and certainly more with it than Biden is.
I mean, I would expect that she could significantly outclass Trump in the debate. And that would be very important. Even Kamala would do a lot better than Biden in the debate.
I guess not. Kamala just seems to be, to me, to be inane. She doesn't come across as serious, even though she may be serious, but she comes across as a goofball.
Maybe America will come to love that laugh. You know, I noticed that like all the clips of her being the people spread around and laugh at, and like 90% of them, she's laughing at the end. There's just something about that laugh that leads to ridicule. And justifiably, perhaps, but
I have one thing nobody's picked up on in advance is that he's heavily influenced by Michael Lind.
Is he? That makes total sense.
And Lind, I sort of admire Lind because he's basically, even though I rarely read him, he has written everything I agree with, you know, for years. So why isn't he prescient like Pat Buchanan?
He kind of is
relatively good. It's just he's very pronatalist. That's the one problem. And I don't quite understand.
Wanting Americans to have lots of babies?
Yeah.
What's wrong with that?
It leads to a refundable child tax credit, Bob. the tax credit is not going to have any effect on natalism, but it's going to have a huge effect on causing dependency. So Vance, to his credit, has not endorsed it. He's on the fence in terms of the tax credit. But he's not
on the tax credit.
Yeah, but he's not on the fence in terms of we need to do something to combat.
Now, Michael Lind has been talking about like the Scots-Irish of Appalachia forever. Is Vance Scots-Irish? Do we know?
Good question. I have some significant
Scots-Irish in me, you know.
I don't think he is a phony. There are all these things saying, of course, he's a phony. He's never struck me as a phony.
Has changed his tune on some things.
She changed his mind on things, but
So you think he really believes the election was stolen? That's what he says.
But I think he really cares about Appalachia and he values it as his home, ancestral home. And the one time I saw him, he wanted me to go to some place in Kentucky and drive around and see see his home turf.
Oh, you've hung out with him? Wait, you buried the lead. You've hung out with JD?
I've met him. I met him once in Cincinnati. He wanted me to go across the river and visit
him. But not with him. He didn't say, come on across the river with me, Mickey. He just said Mickey Scram and pointed to the river. Which was it? These are two very different scenarios.
He said Mickey Scram and pointed to the river. Then he followed up and said, so did you get to see it?
You saw him on two occasions? You guys are like best friends.
Email. He sent an email.
That's something.
So he was mainly busy, I believe, with his wife's father there's some like national test of scientific knowledge or aptitude test or achievement in all of India. Okay. Everybody in India who wants to take this test takes this test. And his father-in-law was the number two in all of India. Okay.
Really?
Yeah. So he's a smart guy. And he was taking care of their kids. He was babysitting their kids. So I think at the time Vance was concerned with.
Yeah. I mean, look, relieving his position on babysitting. I'll tell you one of the big issues. Today's issue of the Non-Zero newsletter gets into his connection to the tech oligarchs and his position on AI deregulation. And I do think there is genuine tension between his professed commitments and his totally laissez-faire approach to AI, which happens to coincide with the preferences of, Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, Mark Andreessen, these guys pouring a shitload of money into the campaign.
I thought Musk was the one who said AI is going to kill us all.
Yeah, but he's still for deregulation because he's, he's for open source, first of all, because his own model is open source. And
what does that mean?
It's been paradoxical. From the beginning, even when he started OpenAI, his line, if you look at what they were saying about why to start OpenAI, the idea was, well, we're going to do this research on the frontiers of AI and just get it out there for everybody to do whatever they will. Because, Musk's concern, depending on how cynical you are, was either a genuine concern about monopolies or oligopolies on frontier AI by the big tech companies like Google, or if you're more cynical, this pissing match with either Larry or Sergey, I forget which one. One of the two Google guys Musk had a big face-off with over AI, where whichever guy it was called Musk speciesist because he wasn't, arguably, according to somebody, because he wasn't willing to cede the human future to the robots or something. Anyway, it was a whole big thing. And by one reading, Musk's big motivation starting OpenAI was just anti-Google. It was just like a pissing match with Google. But in any event, his actual, his professed ideology is get it out there. And it wasn't necessarily open source back then that he was talking about, but he's talking about it now. Anyway, so what
the argument is, it gets it out there to any terrorist who wants to build an AI to destroy humanity.
Well, the tension I was going to argue there is between Vance's commitments and this laissez-faire approach to AI is, you know, Vance is to some extent kind of a Burkean conservative, right? I mean, he's certainly not this libertarian, Friedman conservative.
Right.
And one thing he wants to do is preserve. I mean, shit, he talked about the grave he's going to be buried in, and the fact that it's, whatever. Well, okay. AI is going to be a fucking earthquake. It's going to disrupt everything, and it's going to, including American families. I mean, it is just, that's why I think the slower it goes, the better for the world. It's going to be a huge amount to adjust to. You know, it's who wrote the book, The Cultural Contradictions of Capitalism?
Daniel Bell, I believe.
It's that, right? Like the conservative support of laissez-faire is at odds with the Burkean part of conservatism.
I think Marx had that down in the Communist Manifesto. All that is sacred is profane.
Yeah.
Another
case where the true left is on the same page with some of these Trumpian conservatives.
Marx was for profaning all that is sacred, I believe. Because history was going in his direction, remember?
Was he? No, but he was complaining about the effects of rapid industrialization.
Right, but the rapid industrialization was creating the proletariat that was going to save the world, so he was ultimately for
it. It was heightening the contradiction.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to heighten those contradictions myself. Not too fast.
He supported British imperialism because it was accelerating the heightening of the contradictions, as opposed to the anti-imperialists who wanted to cling to their old sacred ways. That's interesting. Well, he may be full of contradictions. I just don't think he's a phony.
I don't think he's any worse than the average politician. I think he's smart. I think he gave a good speech. He's a very good public speaker. It was a very well-crafted speech.
He should have talked faster. All the speeches were designed, obviously, with the pause for applause. And there was no applause. It was a dead crowd. They weren't that excited until Hulk Hogan came along. So he should have just sped up. The way you give it an effective speech these days is to interrupt the applause. Don't wait for the applause to die down. Surf on the applause. Speed it up. You know, that's the famous Al Gore technique in 2000, and it works. And it works for Condi Rice. It just ignore the applause. Just barrel on. Yeah. Anyway,
I'll keep that in mind.
The one point I wanted to make is all the people on my side are raving about that Vance said America is, and that old veteran said, America is more than an idea. America is our home. This is like the nationalist point against the Paul Ryan point that America is an idea so that anybody can come here as long as they embrace the American idea of freedom. We can welcome them and don't need borders, et cetera, et cetera. I can't believe that veteran and anybody in America doesn't value their home in America more because it is America is the land of freedom and social equality. Okay. So those are ideas. So the idea that you can abstract home from the idea is wrong. And part of it is that Paul Ryan has the wrong idea. Paul Ryan's idea of America is free markets, also equal opportunity. Anybody can rise, to get as rich as they want. And the right idea of America, in my point, is yes, but we have to be equal in the eyes of each other, as Ronald Reagan said. So the problem with inviting all these immigrants is that they undermine the idea of social equality because they deny the people at the lowest rungs a chance to earn a decent living. So it's that Ryan has the wrong idea, and also because the idea has to be embedded in a culture for it to work. So you do need a period of assimilation so that people learn that when somebody's disagreeing with you online, you don't go kill them, right? I mean, it just seems... he's correctly attacking a crazy Paul Ryan idea that America is an idea, Wall Street Journal idea, but America is not, America is an idea.
I was a little, I think I caught that part of the speech out of context. Maybe it wasn't. I didn't even think I watched the whole speech, but I was a little puzzled by it. It's like, just the idea, America's not an idea. Well, everybody believes it is in some sense, right?
He was fighting, yeah, he was fighting against the Wall Street Journal editorial. But he did, you know, this is the virtue of Vance is he offered a summary that sort of took the edge off. He said, as Americans, we welcome immigrants, but we want you to come on our terms, which is pretty close to what I think. And it takes the edge off because he's welcoming immigrants. And that's why he's such a threat to the left, because, or to whoever wants to oppose it, to the Democrats, because he can, like Reagan, he can state fairly strong positions while making them seem oh so very reasonable. He doesn't heighten the contradictions. He makes his point, and you say, well, that's sort of pleasant. That's a sensible fellow. He offered a second view of immigration, which I think is much better.
Well, let me ask you this. If you think there is this like core, you know, enduring ideology within J.D. Vance, and he hasn't been cynically repositioning himself with whatever would get him into power, and I definitely think there are some examples that seem to be cynical repositioning, not necessarily more than the average politician, but anyway, if your position is that he's pretty much the real deal, what did he mean when he first said that Trump was cultural heroin or whatever he said? Trump's promises are the needle in America's collective vein. Trump is cultural heroin. He makes them feel better for a bit.
He bought the whole chattering class view that Trump was a phony and a horrible man. And, you know, whatever he says, he says things you agree with. He's a bad man and you know, he offers a fake cure. I mean,
but obviously, I mean, when he says,
I don't know why
when he says he makes some feel better for a bit, but he cannot fix what ails them. And one day they'll realize it. If he really believes now that like cutting immigration at the border is really a big and important thing, and like tariffs on China are really a big and important thing, well, what was he talking about back then? I mean, what was the fake part? I mean, wasn't this the essence of what Trump was kind of promising?
Well, and it was the essence of what Michael Lind was writing. So if he's a follower of Michael Lind, he should have taken it seriously. I guess maybe he thought that Trump was just a total phony and wouldn't do anything about it. And he didn't build the wall. So it wasn't crazy to think he was a bit of a phony. But he did lower the immigration numbers, and that did help wages. So the answer is I don't know.
I mean, Vance isn't saying, I don't think Trump can deliver the heroin.
You're right. The answer is I don't know. I mean, my line would be he was an aspiring writer and he craved the approval of the people who edit the Atlantic magazine who were publishing him. And he told them what they wanted to hear, like most Atlantic writers.
Well, if that's what was going on then, I don't know why one shouldn't be cynical about the subsequent transition. Why should we believe him anymore now that it's politically convenient to be a Trumpist?
Now he's a big fucking deal on his own. He doesn't have to appeal to anybody.
Well, no. To become the vice presidential candidate, he had to embrace the very ideas he was rejecting in 2016.
Right, but there's no reason to think that the 2016 ideas were his real ideas. I think he's probably migrated to something he really believes in.
Well, I'm just saying, what basis is there to think he has real ideas? All we know is that when he thought it was convenient to say X, he said X. And when it was useful as on his path to power to say Y, he said Y. I'm just saying, you know, that I don't see, you know, I'm agnostic. I'm not accusing him of anything.
He says things in the process of free independent thought that don't do him good. I'm sure he'll become more buttoned down and disciplined, and that'll be a bad thing. But it seems completely clear that he actually believes this stuff about immigration and believes this stuff about trade. So,
a different issue. At some point, I'd like to talk about foreign policy, but
I want to get that. That's the only thing left on my list.
Well, but just quickly, I'm wondering about Tucker Carlson and J.D. Vance. It wouldn't shock me if I see a little passive-aggressive Tucker Carlson coverage of J.D. Don't you think Tucker Carlson wants to be J.D. Don't you think he wants to be president?
Well, who doesn't?
What?
Who doesn't? Yeah, I think the really vicious infighting is the J.D. Vance, Ron DeSantis infighting. I like both of them, but they're both the obvious candidates for 2028.
And DeSantis is roadkill. Are you kidding? DeSantis?
He's not roadkill.
He is roadkill. He's not roadkill,
but he's definitely behind J.D. Vance at the moment.
Have you ever driven through the hill country of Texas, Mickey?
You bet.
Do you know what a dead armadillo looks like? Looks like Ron DeSantis.
I just know that there are all these road signs in German, Bob.
Speaking of which, what was with the opera music at the end of the convention?
It's apparently Trump likes that aria.
Oh my God, was that Italian or what? What the fuck was that?
I think it was a Norma Desu, so it sounds Italian. It's famous, but somebody said no. That's why he went with Wagner. I don't think it was Wagner. I think it was
Italian. I was going to ask, surely this isn't Wagner, right? I mean,
I don't think it was Wagner, but there was some web talk about Wagner.
He's like trolling Bill Kristol.
Anyway, so this leads us to inexorably to foreign policy. What about Vance? Vance seems pretty close to you in Ukraine. What about him don't you like?
Oh, I don't know. First of all, I'm even less inclined to think he has sincere views on foreign policy, because I mean, with domestic policy, you can imagine that his allegiance to his people, his socioeconomic milieu of his origin, is authentic. I don't doubt that, and that could shape a lot of views on domestic policy. With foreign policy, it kind of could, if you think your people are being used as cannon fodder, maybe.
Well, if you served in Iraq and eventually concluded it was a stupid neocon war, you might be legitimately skeptical of neocons.
Now, was he in the action, in the real action, or?
He was in Iraq. I don't know how much action he saw.
Yeah.
But he wasn't just a judge, adjutant general, you know, type who only saw courtrooms. And even those people were risking their lives, but. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I tend to think more. I mean, as for what his real views are, I don't know. I mean, as far as Trump, I consider him and Biden both ultimately scary on foreign policy for different reasons.
I assume you don't like the Biden constantly saying we're there to stop Putin, who will invade Europe if we don't stop him in Ukraine.
No, I don't like that hyperbole. Right. Well, look, I was, you know, as you know, I've been saying for a long time, Biden should use his leverage. Well, he should have used his leverage both on Israel and on Ukraine. But I think the politics, domestic politics of using it would have been pretty doable in the case of Ukraine. But he still didn't. I think he should have pushed Zelensky toward peace talks a long time ago. And I wrote that.
Isn't that what Trump is saying he's going to do?
Trump has said, yeah, he has said. In fact, he has said he got the game theory right. He said this. He said this a long time ago. But he said, "I'll go to Putin." He said, "I'll go to Zelensky and said, if you don't go to the peace talks, I'm going to cut your weapons, and I'm going to go to Putin and say, if you don't go, I'm going to increase the weapons I send to Ukraine." That is the right game theory.
Had signs printed up that were on everybody's seats. Trump will end the Ukraine war.
Well, Zelensky is now scared enough of a Trump administration that just this week, he, for the first time, said he would welcome Russia attending peace talks without demanding that they first, you know, get all the troops out of Ukraine. Right.
And what do you think of the David view put forward by David Sachs in his speech at the Republican convention, which is that Biden, I think, purposely passed up opportunities to forestall the war by, you know, making concessions on NATO, and he didn't want to do it.
Well, I mean, I'd say two things. I mean, Sachs mentioned, as far as leading up to the war, Sachs mentioned, I think, you know, NATO expansion and vowing NATO expansion. I don't think that was all of it. There was also the de facto NATOization of Ukraine, sending in advisors, sending in weapons. Putin explicitly mentioned that in the pre-invasion speech. And even Bill Burns, I think, has alluded to that being a big factor. So it wasn't NATO expansion was part of it, for sure. It wasn't only that, but it's certain, I do think American policy made the invasion more likely, which isn't to say Russia isn't to blame for the violation of international law, but, you know, a wise American foreign policy would not encourage other nations to violate international law in ways that get hundreds of thousands of people killed. The and as for the other thing David was talking about, the after the war started, there have been all these reports that they were close to a peace deal, and the West, and in particular the U.S., kind of pushed Zelensky away from it. This is just weeks after the invasion.
Right.
There were talks in Istanbul for a second. I think there was more than one, like, round of this. I think there's some truth to that. And what's his name? Naftali Bennett, who was prime minister of Israel then, I think, said, he said Western leaders pushed them away from it. He clearly meant America. So there's something to that. There was a deep dive done by Sam, is it Cherup of the RAND Corporation and somebody else? And I respect him, into what exactly happened. And they made it sound less close to a done deal. And so there were still complex issues to tackle. But the drift, I find the basic idea that we didn't encourage that and to some extent discouraged it credible. And it's certainly the case that, you know, in the run-up to the invasion, we ruled out talking about what was clearly one of the most critical, if not the most critical issue to Russia, which is about the status of Ukraine with respect to NATO. And we refused to discuss it.
Yeah. What about the one thing that, that Vance says about Ukraine that I disagree with is he seems to want to give them not a penny more. And it seems to me you give them the money and then you use it as leverage. But
right.
Are you with me or with him?
No, I agree with you. You know, there was recently, there was another one of these things where some like Ukrainian NGO or something does this list of enemies of Ukraine.
Oh, yeah, we're on it.
I was on it. Were you on it?
I'm on it because I'm associated with you. I'm contaminated by the presence.
I think that's the only reason. But the funny thing is they said, the funny thing is, I think they said about everybody on the list, they've opposed funding for Ukraine. I've never actually done that. I did say in the Washington Post in late 2022, wait, is it 2022? Yes, it was that long ago. That Biden should threaten to cut to Zelensky. He should push him to peace talks by using that as leverage and threaten to cut the weapons. Yes, but that's anyway, I wore their scorn as a badge of honor, of course. That's funny that you were on it.
Yeah, you can look it up. I mean, it's online. It's they have nothing. They say nothing about me except that I'm on your podcast.
You're kidding?
No, that's all. That's
they
all
actually say that.
Yeah,
that's so great.
Yeah, it's like one of those things. That's who is he associated with? Who's an evil enemy of Ukraine? Robert Wright. I'd forgotten about that. I should have locked my door.
Years ago, I was also favorably mentioned in like this journal, this thing published by Al-Qaeda for, and the only reason is because I had asserted correctly that some terrorists in America had said that they were doing the terrorism because we were killing Muslims in other countries, which was just true. But it's so unusual, apparently, to emphasize that Al-Qaeda itself embraces you if you say it. So these are among the many accolades.
You should have a space at the top of your website where you have like little
badges of honor. Little
badges of honor, yeah. Exactly. Anyway, you've dragged poor innocent me into the maw of this. It got no traction at all. This enemies was immediately
I didn't
ridiculed.
Even have time to get any Twitter mileage out of it. I didn't even tweet about it. It happened so fast.
That's fast.
That's fast. But quickly on foreign policy, I mean, yeah, you know, there's some virtue in some things Trump is saying in Ukraine, but I think he's more likely to get us into war with Iran than Biden, at least judging by his behavior last time. And he's, you know, he's in cahoots with the hawkish part of the pro-Israel lobby. In particular, Sheldon Adelson's widow, who I just saw the number, incredible amount of money she's going to shovel. And then China, too. I worry about China with Trump, depending on exactly which advisors dominate the administration. That's still up for grabs.
Has Vance said anything about Israel?
Oh, yeah. There was something in Daniel Larrison's newsletter about this. You know me, it may have been about Iran, but of course that means it was about, in terms of domestic American politics, it was about Israel.
Yeah. I don't understand the candidate's attitude towards money, because it seems clear that the past few elections have shown that money is not the decisive factor at this level. Where people, you know, it can affect, you can build a turnout machine that'll help, but most of it's wasted on advertising that has very little effect. And when they really try to turn the screws, like all these rich people were trying to not have him name Vance, Trump said, you know, fuck you, I need your money. Go, okay. Mm-hmm. But then at other times, he slavishly, you know, adheres to the Adelson line. And Biden seems to, you know, to read Mark Halperin's newsletter, the money is one thing that might drive Biden from the race, which seems insane, that the money is driving up. And the one thing I can think of is that they're a little like tribal chieftains in Africa, which is, if the money dries up, it won't affect their candidacy, but all the thousands of people who are on their team will be unemployed. So they feel some responsibility to keep their whole machine running. And it needs like a constant supply of millions and millions of dollars to keep running. So there's that. But rationally, Adelson would not have that much power. You would be able to tell her, you know, thank you, but, you know, I'm making up my own mind. And if you don't want to contribute, don't contribute.
Well, on Trump's side, there's also the evangelicals, you know, many of whom seem to care about Israel. I don't know how heartfelt it is, but it's an issue, and there's a lot of them, and they vote. So if a very big chunk of them really care, that's a lot. There's that. So it's kind of on the Republican side, you got that. And then on the Democratic side, you've got things other than donors too, but different things. But
I understand the evangelical power, because that's people and votes.
Right.
Adelson is just Adelson and money. So.
Well, money's, look, you are unusual in thinking money doesn't matter in politics, Mickey. I mean, they seem to think it'll help them win elections. They grovel for it. I mean, Trump came out of that dinner at David Sachs's house saying full speed ahead on AI. Like 6 months ago, he was saying this AI thing is just scary. Now he's saying, you know, this AI thing is scary, but we got to go full speed ahead anyway. Please.
He sucks up to everybody. He went on the All In podcast and said, we need more high-tech immigrant workers, right? Anybody, he did it worse than that. He said, anybody who graduates from a junior college in America who's not an American should be able to staple a green card to their diploma. So that's like a whole bunch of people who are not getting, you know, they're not number two tech guy in India, okay? We want that.
That's what I'm saying. Politicians care about money. Now, maybe you know more than they do about
politics.
That
wasn't money. That was just him instinctively saying what people wanted to hear.
But wait, he had heard that at fundraising dinners, hadn't he?
No, I think they were pressing him on it during the podcast.
On the podcast? Yeah, but these are the same, the people pressing it on him were the same people who hosted the dinner that got him $15 million.
Jason Calacanis and Chamath. The second one was
sitting next to Trump at that dinner.
Okay.
Chamath or whatever.
That guy. He's tall. I was shocked to learn that he was tall.
He's tall.
He's apparently tall.
Trump does have a sense of humor, I grant you, because apparently, either at this dinner or at something else, you know. So you've seen him. You say he's tall. So you know that.
No, somebody just told me that and I was shocked, because on the radio.
Well, have you seen him?
Have
you
seen him? He sounds short.
He does. No. But have you seen him? Okay. Like, basically,
I know what he looks like, but I don't know how tall he is.
Okay. So you know that nobody's going to get him mixed up with George Clooney. And so apparently Trump, when he met him and his wife is very attractive, and he looked at the wife and said to Chamath, you must be rich. That's pretty funny.
That's a good one. So anyway, I think we're at the end of my list, and we've probably been going for over an hour. Yeah,
has been.
So,
but don't you want it to never end, Mickey? Come on.
It's like Trump's speech, Bob. It's just I'm just comfortable listening to old grandpa.
It's not like that.
You know, tell me about Hannibal Lecter. I didn't even mind the Hannibal Lecter thing. It's like, you know, so what?
Yeah, no, that's not the thing I would have focused on. So do you agree with Tyler Cowen that there's been a vibe shift in Trump's favor?
I found Tyler's list of things that have shifted vibes toward the Republicans convincing, but I haven't noticed a vibe shift because I am so in my cocoon.
Right.
That shift, that nothing, he was just describing the way my cocoon has been for the past 5 years. So, it's not a vibe shift in the Democratic cocoon. It's a vibe shift sort of in the balance of vibe in the public. And I'm in no position to assess that, unfortunately, because of the cocooning effect of Twitter.
Other observers have said they feel the same way. Well, look, in Silicon Valley, there's definitely been a little David Sachs called it. He said on the All In podcast, I mean, weeks and weeks and weeks ago, when he was first coming out as a Trump supporter and so on, he said, let's start a preference cascade, more or less.
Right,
Once it's socially acceptable to do it. Because, you know, these, I actually think he is ideologically motivated. Like, he cares about foreign policy. But I think most of these very rich people, they're just voting with the pocketbooks. They'll get tax cuts from Republicans and less regulation. And they don't give a shit whether Trump subverted the Constitution and so on.
In my neck of the woods, the things that would have turned liberals against Democrats are crime, homelessness, trans people in sports before immigration.
Hmm.
They recognize that immigration is out of hand, but it's not a visceral issue impacting their lives the way crime and homelessness is. So they're anti-woke, but they're not necessarily anti-immigrant.
Honestly, I mean, if you look at the actual crime rate numbers, I'm not sure how many people's lives are impacted in that, but there's a lot of like vivid lawlessness that you see.
It's gone down, but it's gone down from a peak. So it's still higher than I think it was during the peak low crime years. And also, people have a pretty good idea of whether it's safe to go outside and whether it's safe to walk at night. I never worried about walking at night. And then some guy was mugged for a Rolex on my block. And now I worry about walking at night. And then people were and followed home by people in cars and killed and robbed. Okay. Didn't happen before. So you got to trust people on that. It's one of the things they pay a lot of attention to and know about. And they're not influenced by political propaganda. They're influenced by, hey, my neighbor got mugged. So but if they're worried about crime is a problem.
Yeah. It's like, in some neighborhoods.
In every neighborhood, everybody worries about getting mugged.
No, it's not where I live. It's just not. I mean,
I live in fucking Beverly Hills. If it's a problem in Beverly Hills, it's a problem everywhere.
Well, apparently you've got a crime problem in Beverly Hills. I mean, I'm sorry, but I don't have one.
You had a murderer who lived down the block.
What?
I'm not going to say make you say anything got you in trouble, but there's a whole web of corruption in New Jersey politics.
George Norcross does not live near me.
I thought there was a Norcross.
You know, he got indicted. Is that good or what? He got indicted.
I thought there was somebody who was associated with.
There was somebody who had been his chief of staff who lives a few blocks away, but I don't know that he was involved in any particular murders.
Do you know who Josh Shapiro cut his teeth working for?
By the way, I should quickly clarify. George Norcross has not been indicted for murder, leaving aside the question of whether perhaps in an ideal world he would have been.
There was a podcast that basically...
Right, there was a podcast about the mysterious deaths that led the podcast host to discuss George Norcross.
You may have a unique vantage point of this. Josh Shapiro cut his teeth with? I gave away half the game.
Wait a second. What, some semi-corrupt politician in Pennsylvania?
No.
Who?
Robert Torricelli.
I don't know that much about him. I mean, he was in New Jersey. He was New Jersey, right?
And he was, there was some scandal that killed his candidacy, and they had to move heaven and earth to get him off the ballot. It was very similar to Biden. Had to get him off the ballot after the deadline, and they got some court to let Coulter just wrote a column about it. Torricelli agreed to drop off the ballot as long as he wasn't replaced by Frank Lautenberg. So as soon as he dropped off the ballot, the Democratic Party said, and our new replacement is Frank Lautenberg. He was totally double-crossed. So things are vicious, and that may happen to Biden too. Who knows? Once he gives it up, he loses power instantly. I guess he's still president. But
so are you betting that he isn't the nominee?
In the battle between Pelosi and Biden and Mark Halperin.
The one who's willing to cut off the horse's head wins.
Mark Halperin and Robert Costa, I'm with Pelosi and Mark Halperin. That's where I put my money. So I think he will ultimately.
Well,
I'm not saying it's not going to be a huge car crash disaster, but I think it'll happen.
Maybe, but still, it'll be clarifying. And the jump in polls, Trump's bump, I hope it's only a bump, but in any event, it is serving the purpose, I assume, of making it more likely that Biden will get shoved off.
Although to read the savvy insiders, it's not the overall numbers that are really driving it. It's the fact that down ballot, all their candidates in the key district that they watch are now very behind.
Yeah, so like, and a key...
A district they want to win in Michigan is now 7 points underwater.
And I gather the position of donors on this is making it so that even candidates who are not imperiled have to care about it, right? Because donations in general are imperiled.
I guess that's right. I assume it's mainly ideological, which is there's no fucking way any of the Democratic agenda gets enacted if they lose Congress and the Senate, and there's a whole lot of the Republican agenda might get enacted. So I assume they're worried about, you know, the future and substance and the project of the coalition of the Ascendant is in danger.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck.
Final okay. thing.
Okay.
I assume you noticed what song they played after J.D. Vance.
Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow?
Yeah, it was, it wasn't the original, but that was the Bill Clinton Al Gore anthem. That was weird.
That was weird. And also,
see, you know what I think it was? Well, you could argue it as, I think it was a subliminal message, maybe specifically for the tech community or something, that just because J.D. Vance is dwelling on where he's going to be buried in the hills of wherever doesn't mean that he's opposed to progress and blah, blah, blah. I don't know. What do you, why?
I thought he meant that he's the future of the Republican Party. That's why I picked him as vice president.
Mm.
So he's tomorrow. Tomorrow belongs to him.
That's more plausible.
They should have played Tomorrow Belongs to Me. That would have been a ballsy move.
Hold On, I'm Coming was good, but the one before the opera thing. That was smart. Great.
They had the one thing everybody agreed on was they had a really good band.
Oh.
The band was really rocking. Mm-hmm. And so somehow they get these people. There's a great one at Gore's 2000 convention too. Makes all the difference. But I went and looked up to who gets the royalties for Katrina and the Waves Walking on Sunshine, which is the song that every politician uses when they walk on stage everywhere in the world. And they get it. They still control the royalties. So why aren't they the richest people on the planet?
I don't know. But it's one of my favorite blues songs, Mickey. I guess we shouldn't go there. Some people don't get that reference. I'm sorry. Mickey classifies Walking on Sunshine as a blues song.
They saw it as their Motown song. Motown is an outgrowth of rhythm and blues. So
you never know.
I'm sticking by my position.
possibly final thing. Do you know who Nick Bostrom is? Famous philosopher of.
He's one of the, he fears AI. It's like AI is going to kill us all.
That's kind of a stereotype.
He's the goo guy, right?
The gray goo guy is more like Bill Joy of Sun Microsystems.
Okay.
Bostrom, several things. He wrote the book Superintelligence, which deeply influenced all these people. Elon Musk read it. Sam Altman read it. It did get people worried about superintelligence. It's 10 years old. He came up with the paperclip maximizing thought experiment to illustrate how AI can go awry.
Okay.
He's the one who had the argument that it's more likely than you might think that we're living in a simulation. Anyway, so he's this famous guy, right?
Right.
So I had him on my podcast. We haven't, it's actually now available to, well, paid subscribers, Non-Zero Newsletter, members as we call them, but it hasn't gone public yet. But, you know, we do still do this with a lot of people, this overtime segment that even once this goes public, only the overtime segment will be available, paid subscribers. Anyway, so I say my thing and I say, okay, now we're going into overtime. I say that to Bostrom in the conversation and he says, so now are we in, you know, he's got like a Scandinavian accent. So now are we in what they call the parrot room? I thought you'd be flattered.
That's very nice. Yes. So now are we leaving the simulation and going into the real life? Or you could call it garbage time. What we're in now is not overtime. It's garbage time.
Garbage time. It's like the last 45 minutes of Trump's speech.
You win. You got the last line.
Okay. Well, Mickey, as you know, you're always welcome here. And whenever people complain about you not being here, they should really direct the complaints to you.
Fair enough. Thank you for your hospitality.
No one deserves it more than you.
I should put on my non-zero hat.
That's so great.
I'll try. Everybody loves the hat. They just don't know what the hell it means. But,
I should get one.
You should get. Yeah. I have two of them.
Yeah. I mean, it also means the null set in math. That symbol means a null set, but
yeah,
whatever.
Okay.
See, I'm reluctant to press stop, Mickey. I just don't want this to end, you know? So I'm not going to press stop.
Okay. It's going to be awfully lonely. How did Trump end his speech?
I don't know, but 20 minutes before that, he said, like, so I got to end strong. And I thought, God, at last. But no.
No, he was just being self-aware and realizing he was weak.
He's meta. He is meta.
He'd been weak, yeah. He did say in conclusion half an hour before he concluded.
I know, and there's a little bit of, was there a little bit of laughter? Like, they got the Bill Clinton reference
Probably.
Or no?
Do you think it was an intentional Bill Clinton reference?
No, I don't think it was on Trump's part, but that's what I thought of. I mean, famously, that's the speech where when he said in conclusion, they started clapping. I mean, this was before anybody really knew who Bill Clinton was. But.
That's a good example of, that convention was a good example of why is this idea, this professional craft of the well-crafted convention speech is half bullshit. It's because Dukakis gave a well-crafted convention speech. It was very well delivered, very well written, had a memorable line, and it didn't do shit for him.
Right.
Because
Americans crave authenticity, Mickey.
It was authentic.
That's why they're listening to this podcast right now.
He said the problem was competence, not ideology. That was the authentic Dukakis. I am a technocrat. It was very authentic. It still didn't do anything for him.
Oh, well, once they took the picture of him in the tank with the helmet on, that was it was over.
The only speech that's really changed an election is Bush's speech that same year. Because he had been a wimp, okay? Everybody thought he was like this horrible wimp.
This is the first Bush.
Yeah, the first Bush in 88. It was the read my lips speech. He picked Dan Quayle as his vice president. Incredibly stupid choice. More wimp. He's heading down the tubes. And he gives this speech where he seems a changed man. He seemed like a macho man. Saying, read my lips, no new taxes. He unveiled the whatever it is, the 1,000 points of light and the kind.
No, that was in the inaugural.
What about the kind word gentler?
That was in the inaugural. But the The read my lips was a killer line. And of course, the fact that he didn't honor that pledge is what killed him the next time around, right? Yeah, he did wind up raising taxes.
It worked for the election. But anyway, so that's the only time I think it worked. Anyway, okay.
See you next time. Okay. All right.